Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Around the country, with many immigrants and immigrant groups choosing to boycott work, school, and all types of commerce, they hope as a reminder of the impact immigrants have on every aspect of society. But the day is also about a debate within the immigrant community about whether the boycott could provoke a backlash. A demonstration earlier today in Homestead, Florida, drew over 1,200 Mexican immigrants, most of them involved in the state's agriculture industry. Major demonstrations are also taking place today in Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles. Here in Al's, Monica Brady Meyerhoff is covering the story here in Boston. And Monica, Boston's demonstration is scheduled for later today. But what are you seeing? You've been up since early this morning. What kinds of signs might you be seeing that this might be a different day?
Well, I've seen that in pockets of Boston, there are dramatic effects with this boycott. I was in Jamaica Plain, a neighborhood of Boston that has a lot of Hispanics, early this morning. Many of the shops were closed, and they had signs on their door that said, closed for a better immigration reform. And now I'm in East Boston, where Latinos make up 39% of the Boston, 39% of the population. And I'm seeing much of the same thing, closed shops, businesses, restaurants, and a lot of kids out of school. I spoke to one 9-year-old who said, yeah, his mom kept him home from school because of this boycott. So pockets around the city, but then I've also driven around to other areas, and it's business as usual in most of the city, so I wouldn't say that visibly it's brought the city to its knees.
Well, in fact, a large portion of this population is invisible to many Americans. Is that one of the things you're seeing, that we might not know if some immigrants take the day off?
That's right. I mean, the top two employers of immigrants are health services, like nursing assistants, and food services, hotels, cleaning, behind the scenes, really. And one Latino organizer told me that the majority of the immigrants work at night. So when Boston shuts down at 5 p.m., the Latino cleaners go into the offices and clean at 5 p.m. So a lot of it is an invisible workforce that, you know, I can't see just by asking a few shop owners and driving down the street. I think as the day progresses, we'll get a better idea of the overall impact.
Well, and you were saying early this morning on Morning Edition, I heard you say that the bus stops were empty and the buses were empty, which might give us a clue what's going to happen later in the day. But it does sound as if, at least in the city of Boston, we're going to check around the country, it's different everywhere, but the boycott is potentially going to largely affect the communities in which immigrants live. The restaurants are closed, their businesses are closed within their communities.
That's right, and one restaurant owner told me he's closed really because he fears that if he doesn't close, he could face a backlash from his own community. And I also should point out that it is really focused, at least in Boston, on the Latino community. The Vietnamese community in Boston, which is very large as well, is not participating in the boycott, although one organizer told me they do support reforms. And in the Haitian community, I talked to somebody in the nursing care industry, which employs a lot of Haitians, and they say they haven't heard anything about a mass walkout today. They feared one, but so far nothing's happened. And one Haitian woman told me, said there's a lot of fear in that community that they could lose their jobs.
Right. This is a part of the debate we were speaking of, that there's not one voice within the immigrant community about whether or not to participate in today, and it sounds like you're hearing that.
That's exactly what I'm hearing, and it seems pretty strong within the Latino community. But even unions are on the other side of this. Now, some unions who represent a lot of Latino cleaners have told me they do not support this. They've told their members, go to work, it's in your union contract, and don't violate it by boycotting work today.
Well, thank you, Monica. Monica Brady Meyerhoff covering today's Great American Boycott here in the Boston area. Monica, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we want to check in around the country. First in New York City, where there were 1.4 million immigrant workers in a 2003 study, according to the Fiscal Policy Institute. Those workers account for 47% of the city's resident workforce. Most are employed by the restaurant industry. Here's Mei Chen. She's vice president of United Here. That's a union representing both hotel and restaurant workers. We spoke to her earlier. She also represents the textile industry.
The garment industry would totally cease to function without immigrant designers. So the Chinese historically were the first victims of exclusion laws that passed by the federal government, that any new law that's passed related to immigration will affect all immigrants, and the Chinese immigrants really understand that, and so we'll be there today to show our support.
That's Mei Chen of United Here, and that's in New York City. Well, in Chicago, massive demonstrations are expected to cause citywide gridlock, and many business owners have opted to shut down, some in solidarity with the protesters, as we're going to hear, but others because it doesn't make sense to stay open when the city's shut down. Jessica Torres's family owns the Taqueria El Mazon restaurant in the Chicago suburb of Cicero. Her dad, Jose, decided to close the restaurant today so that his 18 employees could take part in a rally there. And Jessica, this was not an easy decision for your dad. What were some of the things the family had to think about?
Well, we had to think about that if we were to keep open, only the immediate family, which is three of us, would be able to work the place, when usually we have 15 to 16 workers per day. We also did it to support our workers. I know they have families and they were all going to be out there. You know, Mondays are our days of shipment and we receive all our vegetables, meats, and actually no one was going to be able, everybody called and told us, you know what, we're not going to be able to deliver, we're going to be closed. Well,
so how much money might you lose today?
Roughly, we're not sure, but I mean, I say $1,000 to $2,000.
But that's a lot of money for a small restaurant. Why else did your family want to participate in this rally and boycott?
Well, a big reason was because my father, I mean, long time ago, well, both my parents came here illegal many, many years ago, and now they're legal, and, you know, they think that maybe they deserve a chance, you know?
The same chance that your family had.
Yeah, that once, exactly. Now my parents have a business, they're working well, they're living here well, and we think that maybe the people who are here should get a chance.
Well, so your business caters to immigrants, and they wanted you to back them. But I'm wondering, are you worried about a backlash from other people, from people who oppose the rally?
It could be possible, but we don't think it's going to be that way.
Jessica Torres, her family owns the Taqueria El Mazon restaurant in Cicero, Illinois, just outside Chicago. Jessica, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
And now to Los Angeles, where authorities have been preparing for hundreds of thousands of protesters to march down Wilshire Boulevard there. With us on the line from L.A. is Akelina Soriano of the Filipino Workers Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we hear that many DJs on the Spanish language radios in L.A., which number one stations in the city, and they're the fellows who helped organize past protests. But today they're warning people that they could lose their jobs if they don't go to work today. Do you fear that?
There is that always that risk of retaliation, but actually we found that there's all sorts of employers that are actually allowing their employees to participate in the action today. So, for example, the Korean Business Association throughout Koreatown is giving their employees a day off if they want to participate.
Do I understand that Democrats in the state actually passed a resolution in support of the action?
Yes.
Yeah. How many illegal Filipino workers are there, do you guesstimate, and what kind of work do they do?
Mm-hmm. Well, we estimate there could be up to 1 million undocumented Filipinos. According to the census, they estimate about 100,000, but we know that that's a big undercount.
A lot of Americans have been asking, how is it that so many illegal immigrants can gather in these large gatherings and they're not arrested and deported? This is, it sounds like, a move to come out of the shadows, as you said. Are there some people who are afraid of coming out of the shadows?
A lot of people are, but they're coming out anyways, one, because they have the support of the overall community. So this is really a mixed mobilization of people of different status. But then they've also seen that these laws are so bad, criminalizing, you know, undocumented immigrants just for their status, that they have to come out now because it's going to make their lives and the community lives so, so horrible.
Akelina Soriano of the Filipino Workers Center, thanks for speaking to us from Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Well, protests aren't happening just in the U.S. South of the border, Mexicans are being encouraged to boycott U.S. businesses there and not to cross the border to work at businesses here. Enrique Davalos of the Workers Information Center is helping to organize a protest in Tijuana, Mexico, just over the border from San Diego. And Enrique, tell us what you're planning there.
Okay, for today we are planning a demonstration, a protest in the Tijuana industrial area as well as in the U.S. consulate and also in the border.
And what are people going to be saying? These are people in Mexico. What are they going to be saying?
They are going to send a double message. on one hand, we are protesting the low salaries and the bad labor conditions in the maquiladoras here in Tijuana.
These are the factories, the American factories that are in Tijuana.
Correct. They are a number of factories that used to be in the U.S. and other countries, and now they are located here in Mexico, especially in Tijuana.
Mm-hmm. And what's the second part of the message?
The second part of the message is that we are going to protest in the U.S. consulate as well as in the border, supporting the May 1st action boycott in the U.S. For immigrants' rights.
Do you understand how Americans might resent that? They feel that there are millions of Mexicans who are working illegally in the U.S. and, you know, don't have the right to criticize anything. I mean, that is the viewpoint of many Americans. Do you understand that?
Yes, but I also understand that these immigrants with or without documentation are making an important contribution to the economy and to the culture of the country.
Well, and there's another element of your protest today. You're telling Mexicans not to cross the border into the U.S. Now, a lot of advocates for stronger immigration laws are going to say that's a good thing and keep it up. You understand that they think that should happen every day. Why are you telling Mexicans not to cross the border?
Well, in general, some of the media people said that the Mexicans are a problem with the immigrants in general, but also the Mexicans are the problem for the U.S. economy. So on May 1st, when we are stopping buying and going to work and supporting in the Mexican side, what we are going to show is that essentially we are needed, that we are part of the U.S. economy. Every day, more than 75,000 people cross the border from Tijuana to San Diego to work.
These are people who are, as you said, crossing legally to do work. What companies are they working at, and what companies are you asking people to boycott?
We are asking in Tijuana to boycott Costco, Sam's Club, Home Depot, McDonald's, and Burger King.
Sam's Club, of course, the Walmart. What kinds of jobs do people who cross legally into the San Diego area, what kind of work do they do?
It's very diverse. They work taking care of the elders, clean up the backyards of houses, mm-hmm. but also they work in many important industries, as hotel, as well as fast food industries and restaurants. Another business.
Mm. Economists have said that a one-day boycott really won't make a dent. Do you think it will?
In terms of the political message, is going to be important. Definitely, it's going to send a message to the politicians that that there are millions of people that should be considered in this debate, and not only for a group of politicians.
Enrique Davalos is with the Workers' Information Center. He's helping organize a protest today in Tijuana, Mexico. Enrique, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, and now we turn to Elias Bermudez. He's with the group Immigrants Without Borders. They're based in Phoenix, and he's organized recent protests there, but he's decided to change his focus today. He's in San Francisco. Elias, we're going to take a break in just a few seconds and spend more time with you, but before we do, just give me a couple of lines here. What is your main concern today?
Our main concern is for people to stay home. We are calling our protest today the deafening silence of our absence, and we're just asking our folks to stay home, be with family, do not work, do not buy, and do not send your kids to school.
But you also have concerns that maybe too many demonstrations could lead to a backlash, that organizers have to be wiser about where the demonstrations are held, you know, to try to figure out the best way for reform. We're going to talk more with Elias, who again has some concerns about this day. More with him when we come back. Called the National Day Without Immigrants. We just heard from some organizers in a few big cities about the need for reform. Also heard from someone in Mexico where there's also a boycott being planned. But not all advocates are in agreement about the way to achieve reform. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is urging immigrants to attend Mass instead of staying home from work and school and boycotting stores. And other lay groups don't want protesters to go too far. Elias Bermudez is with the group Immigrants Without Borders. As we said, he's based in Phoenix, and he has organized recent protests there. But Elias, you're telling people in Phoenix to do what today? To go to work today?
To stay home. Ma'am. What we're trying to do, and you probably have heard this before, as organizers, as leaders, we must be very wise as to how we utilize this newfound power in the people to be for the people and not for self-aggrandizement. And I think that at this point in time, we really need to, for this day, we need to give America the taste of our participation
but we
in the
understand,
economy.
But we understand, Elias, and maybe we're confused a little, but we understand you're in San Francisco today instead of in Arizona because your fear is that there have maybe been too many demonstrations in Arizona and organizers have to balance things a little more.
Well, and that's where I'm coming from. We need to use this newfound power wisely to affect change. And the only way that our government officials are going to listen to us is if we try to reach everybody at a middle ground situation. If we continue to push the envelope too far, then we might not be able to negotiate a position. And we also must be willing to know that negotiating also what we are asking our government to do for the political realities of our world. We need security at the border first and foremost. But by the same token, by providing security at the border, we must have those people who come across the border illegally to have an avenue where they can come here legally. And, ma'am, in Phoenix, Arizona, over 750,000 people have stayed off from the streets of Phoenix, and that's, for us, a truly an accomplishment.
Well, but you also worry about the stress on the city. For instance, we understand you were worried about how much the cities had to pay for police protection during the demonstrations.
That's the reason why I do not agree with marches at this in this day is because we have asked the city to do more than enough. And I think at this point in time, police protection for a large demonstration that I don't doubt our people would have come out more than 500,000 in Phoenix this time around. But now our silence and us to staying home is going to create more of an impact. Large companies have closed down, and we just need to show these people that believe that we're here to hurt America financially or whatever, please let this be known. We are here to contribute to the greatness of this country, and we will not stop until we are recognized for that contribution. We're not asking for special favors. We don't want you to treat us differently than anybody else. Give us the same opportunity that this country gave your forefathers. Give me your hungry and your poor, your huddle masses, and that's what we're here for.
So you're saying to people in cities like Phoenix, which have seen a lot of protests, stay home, maybe don't go to work, but don't put more stress on the city by taking to the streets.
Exactly. We need to be accommodating at the same time that we ask for others to respect our rights. We have to respect the right of others. And being on the streets, it is being done already. We have shown that that position. We had the largest march in the history of the state of Arizona. And now all we have to do is stay out of the way of other people, contemplate family time that you badly need, and show the support and show our economic participation, and that's what we're here for.
Elias Bermudez of the group Immigrants Without Borders. He's based in Phoenix, but he's in San Francisco today because he feels that Phoenix perhaps has had enough street demonstrations. One of many of the organizers today who's rethinking the approach to the boycott and to the goal of immigrant reform. Elias, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me, and we look forward to a solution to this problem.
Okay, thank you. Well, we'll have more on immigration reform over the course of the week. But this past weekend, the White House Correspondents' Dinner was held, the annual event where Washington scribes and the people they write about make fun of each other. Well, last night, the keynote speaker made fun of both. Steve Colbert, who plays a dim-witted right-winger on the satirical Colbert Report, spoke on the dais just feet from President Bush. Here's a taste as we go into the break.
I believe the government that governs best is the government that governs least. And by these standards, we have set up a fabulous government in Iraq. I believe in pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. I believe it is possible. I saw this guy do it once in Cirque du Soleil. I stand by this man because he stands for things. Not only for things, he stands on things. Things like aircraft carriers and rubble and recently flooded city squares. But the rest of you, what are you thinking? Reporting on NSA wiretapping or secret prisons in Eastern Europe? Over the last 5 years, you people were so good. Over tax cuts, WMD intelligence, the effect of global warming, we Americans didn't want to know, and you had the courtesy not to try to find out. Because really, what incentive do these people have to answer your questions after all? Everybody asks for personnel changes. So, the White House has personnel changes. And then you write, oh, they're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. This administration is not sinking. This administration is soaring. If anything, they are rearranging the deck chairs on the Hindenburg.
Steve Colbert of the Colbert Report on Comedy Central. Speaking at this past weekend's White House Correspondents' Dinner, notice how the White House reporters didn't laugh as much when they were the object of the joke. Well, stay with us. Much more ahead, including a new report on sickle cell anemia, all that and more, here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. You've heard of the Jerry Lewis Telethon. And Dr. Barry Zuckerman says sickle cell anemia needs the same kind of PR campaign. Dr. Zuckerman is co-author of a new study that compares sickle cell, which is an inherited blood disease that mostly affects African Americans, with cystic fibrosis, a genetic disease that affects the lungs and largely affects whites. The study finds huge gaps in public and private research and treatment between the two diseases, despite the fact that about 80,000 people have sickle cell anemia and around 30,000 have cystic fibrosis. The new study echoes a report done by Dr. Robert Scott 35 years ago that also compared the two diseases with similar results. That study then led to improvements in treatment for sickle cell, along with an increased lifespan for sickle cell patients. And Dr. Zuckerman, chair of pediatrics at Boston Medical Center, says there's been a backslide, so he hopes this new study will do the same, lead to improvement. And Dr. Zuckerman joins us. Help us understand what sickle cell is. You say there's a theory that it developed to prevent malaria, where that disease is common, so that could be why it rarely affects whites. And we know that the people who have it, their red blood cells are sickle-shaped. That's how the disease gets its name. But tell us more. What are the symptoms?
Sickle cell anemia is a disease of the blood where the actual red blood cell, because of a genetic difference, becomes deformed, and it can no longer carry oxygen. And because it can't carry oxygen, it can cause significant destruction of other organs. One of the other characteristics unusual for a disease in general is what we call pain crisis in children. So children can get up in the morning or, during the day and have significant pain in their hands and their back and their arms and the legs that require hospitalization and very strong medicine. And over the course of time, the organs get damaged.
Before you did your study, you look back to research done 35 years ago that compared treatment and resources for sickle cell. What did that study say?
Well, that study was very important by Dr. Scott because he brought attention to the nation that there was inadequate funding for sickle cell anemia. And he made a comparison between sickle cell and cystic fibrosis in terms of federal funding for research. The influence of this was particularly important, and there were congressional hearings that led to funding of comprehensive sickle cell treatment centers around the country. This had a huge impact, increasing attention and funding for sickle cell anemia. It started in 72, and made great progress. But really, from 1985 on, the progress has sort of changed. And again, we see the discrepancy that Dr. Scott spoke about 30 years ago. And Dr. Scott drew the parallel between funding and recognition of sickle cell anemia and civil rights. And I see the same kind of parallel at this time.
Yeah, but this is 30, 35 years later. So let's talk about some of the things that you found. Again, a huge discrepancy between the funding and research for sickle cell and cystic fibrosis. And we want to hasten to say that we're not comparing these illnesses for any other reason but to show the discrepancy. Of course, everyone wants to, you know, bring help to people who have cystic fibrosis. But it was interesting to us, for instance, that you found the role of private organizations went well beyond funding. For instance, you found that both sickle cell and the cystic fibrosis organizations helped lobby for and pass legislation. But sickle cell was kind of left in the dust by Cystic Fibrosis Foundation's ability to do PR and also implement care. Tell us about that.
The money raised by private philanthropy is 300 times greater for cystic fibrosis than sickle cell anemia. But these private groups bring attention to a disease. They advocate in federal legislation. They bring resources to care for children. They reduce stigma. It's quite remarkable that children with sickle cell anemia do not like to tell their friends or teachers, because it has a long tradition in this country as being a disease of, quote, bad blood, close quote. These organizations also have mechanisms to improve the quality of care. So I think someone needs to stand up and, again, bring attention to children and adults who have sickle cell anemia, because they deserve the same kind of care and attention that all children with other diseases, regardless of their race.
Well, Doctor, why is it that the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation is, as you write, so able to disseminate positive images about the disorder, whereas sickle cell is not? And as you said, kids are left with this social stigma.
I think in the case of cystic fibrosis and other disease, they've had some important visible champions, and that really matters. I can't help but think, when I see the disparity of the kind of funding and the kind of attention, that race doesn't have something to do with it. That if sickle cell anemia was a disease that also included whites, that maybe there would either be people or more public attention that would contribute to more equitable funding and equitable attention.
You see some of these patients with sickle cell?
I see those patients regularly, and I think that's why we decided to do the paper, because to see these children admitted to the hospital in these pain crises, and in some children that get strokes, it's very difficult. We're, as pediatricians, we know children get sick. We can do a lot of things medically for them, but I think we would like to have the same kind of resources for children with sickle cell anemia as we have for other diseases. And by looking back and looking at these numbers, we realize that we've really, relatively speaking, lost progress in providing the kind of quality care and research that I believe is needed.
You say strokes in children? I mean, this is causing strokes in children. How old, and how does it impact them?
Children at any age, again, because the damaged red cells come together and they cause strokes just like they do adults. Adults have it because their blood vessels are damaged and they're older. But for these children, in a very simple way, the red cells get damaged and they clog up and you don't get oxygen going to the brain, and they can have strokes. We do have treatments to diagnose which children are at risk for strokes, and we can do blood transfusions to really prevent it, and that's wonderful. But when we look around the country, we see that this quality practice is not implemented uniformly. And that's the whole thing with quality care, that we hope that both funders and philanthropic groups will step up to the table, because you need resources to develop quality care mechanisms, in some ways, as has been developed for cystic fibrosis. So we just want to level the playing field.
Dr. Zuckerman, this is part of your medical world, that diseases really do have to elbow their way to the front of the line, don't they, to get attention and money?
None of us want to pit one disease against another. This is unique in the sense that one racial group has this disease, as opposed to a disease that both blacks and whites may have. And we believe, as the physicians caring for those children, it's our obligation to not just treat each individual child, but bring information to the attention of the public and public officials and others in this country who are responsible for funding research and care.
Be their elbows.
We're trying.
That's Dr. Barry Zuckerman. He's chair of pediatrics at Boston Medical Center. Also, he's co-author of a study on sickle cell anemia disease in the journal Pediatrics. The study calls for increased public and private support for research and treatment of the disease. It's a disease that affects around 80,000 people in the United States, most of them African American. For more about it, visit our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Deep in the heart of Texas oil country, some residents are telling the ExxonMobil Corporation, don't mess with us. The leaders of Bee County in South Texas have become the first in the state, maybe the country, to pass a resolution asking drivers to boycott Exxon fuel pumps beginning today to protest high gas prices. Well, joining us first on the line from Beeville is the county's highest elected official, County Judge Jimmy Martinez. He also proposed the boycott. And Jimmy, why target Exxon?
Well, of course, you know, if when you have a giant like them awarding some of their people that are retiring as much as $400 million, there's something wrong here, and we need to start somewhere. We don't have the answers. We need to start somewhere. We are, however, responsible to our constituents at the local level. We are the closest to the people. You know, we sit here with them at ground zero every day. We hear their complaints. This is not about politics. This is about pain, suffering, and sacrificing.
Well, we understand Beeville is a small town. It's about an hour's drive from places like Walmart and other businesses, so people need to drive. And I'm wondering, some people would say that people need to earn a living from the gas stations. We're going to speak in a moment to Leticia Munoz. Her family owns the three Exxon gas stations in Bee County. And, you know, she says these are family-owned businesses.
That's correct. And we're in support. We are in support. And I've sent out a mail in support of their businesses. Let me tell you, they don't make the money at the pump. They get one penny per gallon that they sell of gasoline. And if they pay with the credit card, they have to pay the credit card people. They make zero. They make the money in what they sell inside the store.
So are you saying you're still telling Bee County residents to go in and buy food at the convenience store but not buy the gas?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's where they make their money. It's not at the pump.
Bee County Judge Jimmy Martinez, he's leading a boycott of ExxonMobil gas stations in the heart of Texas oil country in Beeville, Texas. Judge Martinez, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Let me also, if I may, I'd like to hear from the rest of the country at judgemartinez@yahoo.com. That's judgemartinez@yahoo.com.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And we turn now to Leticia Munoz. Her family owns the Exxon gas stations, as we said, in Bee County. And Leticia, the judge says that you're not making money off the gas anyway. So how did you feel about this called for boycott, and how is it going in reality?
Well, actually, we've been swamped with customers all morning long in our support, coming in and saying, we support you, we're not going to boycott. They've been coming in. We've had a constant flow of people filling up, notes being, I had one note left on my desk this morning that said, I've been in, filled up my Suburban, and I've got five other vehicles coming in to fill up with you this morning.
So you think there's a backlash going on?
No, I think that the Bee County just really realizes that I'm being caught up in something that I have no control over. The judge was correct. We do not make any money off the fuel sales. The sales are inside the store. But when you tell someone not to come in to fill up, that pretty much, in today's society, the convenience is so important. Time. Don't have the time to stop and get groceries at one store and fuel at another. That's the purpose of having a convenience store, is to come in and get everything at one time. And that's where the problem is, that people are just coming in and just saying, okay, you know, we're going to support you. We know, we realize that you have no control over this. You're getting caught up in something that you have absolutely, positively no control. We're still going to support you.
Well, Leticia, I want to ask you, do you have any control? I mean, we heard the judge talk about ExxonMobil paying a $400 million compensation package to its CEO. Also, last week, Exxon announced record profits once again. Do you ever say anything? Is there anyone you can talk to? How do you feel about the high price of gas?
Well, I think it's crazy. I'm a working-class woman also, family, that we're just trying to make ends meet also, and it's crazy to hear the record, the amount of money, that's profits that are being made out there. But I wish I had control, but we have absolutely no control over it.
There's no sort of, owners of gas station phone line where you can call ExxonMobil and register your complaint, nothing like that?
No, not so ever.
Leticia Munoz, her family owns the three Exxon gas stations in Beeville, Texas, where the county just passed a resolution asking residents to boycott the Exxon fuel pumps to protest high gas prices. And Leticia, we just want to say we understand you're driving on the way to the hospital because your daughter's having a child.
Yes, I'm fixing to become a grandmother for the first time. I'm really excited. It's just so much excitement going on in my life at this moment.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, you're welcome.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. state? That's the question posed by a new play called Boots on the Ground. It's at the Trinity Repertory Theater in Providence, Rhode Island. Almost 200 hours of interviews with Rhode Islanders have been culled into a 90-minute performance in which actors speak the words of soldiers, their spouses, and so many others with a role in the war. In this scene, a mother whose son is serving in Iraq talks about living with worry.
It's 24/7. You sleep with the phone next to you. Every time a car slows down in front of your driveway, your heart stops, especially if it's an official-looking car. You watch the news despite the fact that you don't want to. Every time there's a death report, which is very seldom because the news very seldom reports on it, it's the most insulting thing. You have to watch the little tape under CNN while they're squawking on about Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt.
Here Now producer Emiko Tamagawa sat down with some of the people involved in the making of Boots on the Ground, beginning with co-creator Dee Salem Smith, who says she was looking for the people behind the headlines.
We never actually found an interviewee based on their politics. It was always based on just a story or how the war might have touched them. We never went in knowing if they were technically Republican or Democrat or what have you. So the politics becomes very, very secondary.
A lot of the stories are very personal, so you're asking people to really open up to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was amazing. People were very generous. I mean, most, you know, the idea that you knock on someone's door, not quite literally, we would call them before, but then to go in and sit down in their home for, you know, up to 90 minutes, sometimes up to 2 hours, and be asking them about the war in Iraq, which is a very emotional topic for many people. So it was a pretty incredible experience, quite humbling, actually, most of the time. And people were very generous. I think people felt like they really welcomed an opportunity for someone to be listening to what their experience was like.
Dropping Christian off at the airport. I still remember that day. I remember exactly what I was wearing, what I felt like.
My name is Amy Neary. I was portrayed in Boots on the Ground as one of the families whose husband was serving in Iraq. I remember leaning over to Christian very early on and saying, "Do I sound like that? Am I that dramatic?" But overall, they and Rachel, certainly for my character, did a wonderful job. Her delivery might have been different. Her tone might have been a little different. But the fact that they maintained the integrity of my words was very important. And we're very grateful for that because I think it does tell the story of one couple.
Your husband, a lot of what he says is really personal. What was that like for you to see that as well?
Some of those things I had heard before, but a lot of it I was hearing for the first time just in terms of his thoughts and feelings. So that was really unique to just sit and listen and hear Christian through someone else's voice up on stage.
I call it my best day in Iraq. I remember having such a great day with Chris Potts. We had rebuilt schools and given them power and water and actually provided our battalion MDs to do immunizations.
My name is Christian Neary. I commanded the Alpha Battery of the 1st Battalion, 103rd Field Artillery Brigade of the Rhode Island Army National Guard in Iraq. Yeah, October 2nd, 2004 was my best day in Iraq. And it was the day that the schools came back into session for the first time in a year and a half. My unit and our sister units were responsible for influencing about 10,000 children. It was amazing. It was what a soldier wants to see when he's trying to do the best part of what he's trained to do.
Can you think of other things that were you able to make a difference that you really felt good about?
Our camp was Camp Taji, which was about 15 miles north of Baghdad. And that camp had between 2,000 and 5,000 local civilians come in every day to work. I think the joy that I really had was, on a daily basis, was these folks coming in and clearly being just so happy to have a good job that was going to make a good wage where they were actually helping the folks that were trying to help them. Because I never met an Iraqi that wanted us to leave. They all want us to stay. They want us to leave when it's safe. And that's what you hear constantly from those Iraqis is, "Hey, stay around. When it's safe, leave." I still get emails to this day from folks in Iraq, and they tell me the same thing.
You talked about your best day. Another thing, of course, that's a major part of the show is one of your worst days. You lost a couple of people.
That day was very similar to a lot of other days. It was October 3rd. It was the day after my best day. Sergeant Chris Potts from Tiverton, Rhode Island, was conducting missions just south of our camp. He arrested some folks, and then as he was arresting them, somebody took a shot at them from afar, from a village that was along the river. Unfortunately, they took his life as he protected his own soldiers and pushed them back so they wouldn't be in the line of fire. A step beyond that is our medic. He was also in that squad that day and responded to provide immediate medical care to Sergeant Chris Potts. And he also was killed. An impression that will forever remain in my mind. I can still remember the radio call coming in that I could hear the rounds being fired over the radio. And I can remember the radio calls coming in, giving me real-time information from 100 feet above. I think you got a guy down. And I think you have two guys down. I think you need to send your quick reaction force now if they're not already on the way. And that'll forever remain in my mind.
One thing that I remember very distinctly from the show was this real difficulty that a lot of soldiers had going back to normal life.
The biggest challenge that I've seen personally and professionally with my soldiers is trying to find relevance in your work back at home. You go from an awesome responsibility of not only taking care of yourself, but taking care of your comrades to your left and right, and if you're a first-line leader, 5, 6, 7 individuals, in my case, in charge of 80 folks. You go from an awesome responsibility where you're responsible for everything that you do to come back to be a salesman like me. I'm very good at it. But at times you look back and you say, hey, this is not nearly as profound or as important as what I did just a couple of months ago.
Support for the war itself seems to be at an all-time low. I'm just wondering how you feel about that.
This country of ours took 12 years to become a country. These folks have only been doing it for 3 years. And they've been hundreds of years without a democratically or a representative democracy. And one thing that really does kind of get on our nerves is we hear we support the soldier, but we don't support the war. It's kind of being hypocritical. It's like supporting women who want to be mothers, but not supporting child care. You can't have one without the other.
Would you go back to Iraq?
I've been asked, and my answer to those folks is, are you asking for me, or are you asking for somebody who has similar qualifications? And the answer I always get is, we're asking for somebody with similar qualifications. And my answer to them is, I'd ask you to ask them if they haven't gone before first. And if I'm the last guy, I'll go. Because some 15 years ago, I raised my hand and I said I would serve at the pleasure of the president, regardless of who he was. President Bush, President Clinton. Doesn't really matter to me. And so if that day comes, which I think it will, before I hit 20 years, I'll probably have to go somewhere else. And that's just the way it is.
That's Major Christian Neary. He and his wife Amy are among the people portrayed in the new play, Boots on the Ground. We also spoke with the play's co-creator, D. Salem Smith. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now. Army